Do you know how it hurts your eyes to stare at the horizon? If you stare at the horizon long enough, all you can see is fire. The entire line of the horizon is burning. Fires as far as the eyes can see.
"I want to fulfill all your sexual fantasies," she told me with her best sincerity act. But what she really means is that she wants to mindfuck me into pushing her own carnal desires to another level. Cut me. I need that right now. It's the only way I'm going to get any satisfaction. "Fuck you," I said. "You're crazy. Go fuck yourself." She begged, and part of me wanted to do it. Part of me wants to use her like a faithful cum rag. Part of me wants to see her burn in hell for what she's done to me. Part of me wants to run this knife through her guts. But how do you explain that in the morning? It's hard to hide a body. "Fine, I'll cut you. But you better come or this is a waste of my fucking time." I carved a star like an 8-year-old into her leg. She bled. The blood was dripping onto the hardwood floors of our 300-square-foot apartment on the Lower East Side. I watched her skin separate, while a valley of deep red blood started to run down the side of her leg. She took the pain very well, but it's nothing compared to what she did to me. "You didn't come. I wanted to see you squirt, you bitch. You fucking lied again." "Do it again," she said. "You can write your name." And I thought for a moment, that would be interesting. The next guy she fucks to see my name scarred into her leg and realize that he's with a really dirty bitch. "Fuck that. You're not even trying to come. Fuck off." I just thought of the blood. I thought about how much blood scares me and how she probably has some kind of terminal disease. Thought about how many times we fucked without a condom and how the morning after pill started to almost become a laughable game. She probably has AIDS and I probably have whatever she has. She's never going to make it out alive and she knows it. When she goes back to LA, it would be like this never happened. She's going to continue to lie and cheat and steal, just like her mother taught her. Her parents should be shot in the face. She pretends that she's not affected when all I see is the misery of her parents' lives, filled with regret, taking hold of her everyday thoughts and actions. She ignores the fact that her crackhead father decided it was okay to stick his dick in her. And when she has fun pretending that it's not a big deal, she pretends that it's not a big deal. She wants to fuck everyone like how everyone fucked her. And all she needs is for you to come close so you can get caught in her web of insanity. She really is an evil person. She will kill me and she will kill you. Go ahead, get close. It's funny because she doesn't even really know how to fuck.
Die! Die! have a radio station, and I barely talk on my own radio station. And, you know, the truth is that when I first got into this, I did it because I love talk radio and I wanted to talk about things, but because of, you know, my own insecurities about my skill level on the microphone and my ability to talk about interesting things, I avoid it. And that kind of sucks. I have a fucking radio station, and I have a lot of things that I would like to talk about. And I have absolutely no reason not to do it. And so I'm gonna talk about a lot of different things right now, because there's just so much to the whole story, right? You know, it's not something that can be summed up in a segment or it all adds up. And I'm talking about, you know, what has made me who I am today, and why do I think the way that I do and act the way that I do? Where does the insanity come from? Because I am most definitely insane, and I've gotten to the point where insanity is almost synonymous with comfort for me. When I was young, I grew up in a very small town in northeastern Pennsylvania, about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes outside of Philadelphia, about 2 hours from New York City. The town I grew up in was a white bread small town. Where people don't leave. And it's not because they don't have the opportunity to leave. There's just this overwhelming sense in you from a very young age in that town that there is no reason to leave. There's nothing out there. You got everything you need right here. Everybody outside of this place is crazy, and you know, stay here where you're safe and nothing ever happens. And this never sat well with me from a very young age. And I guess it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, my father did go places, and when I was young, we were moving around a lot because he was in the military, and I was born in Hawaii, and we lived in Washington State and South Carolina and probably a few other places that I don't even remember. But where I grew up, you know, put it this way, my mother would love for me to move back home and live with her, live out the rest of my days in her house and never going anywhere and not really having the experiences that I've been fortunate enough to have in my life. And she doesn't do it out of spite. It's not that. It's just there's a loneliness there. There's an emptiness there that people don't like to see other people having experiences that they're too scared to have on their own. But, you know, it didn't work for me, and my goal was to get out of there as soon as I possibly could. My first opportunity to really leave was through computers. And I remember, you know, thinking to myself, you know, wow, I would love to make, by the time I'm 50, you know, it'd be great to make like $50,000 a year and own a house and white picket fence. And, you know, at this time, I already assumed, you know, that I was going to be married by a normal age and you know, the whole American dream right there. And things shifted because I found this new power within the computer industry to actually go other places. And, you know, there are much better places than small town PA if you have these skills. And my first opportunity was with Red Hat Software. And I was just shocked that I was given this opportunity. It didn't work out. I went down to North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina, when Red Hat was still working out of an office in Durham. They had yet to move into Research Triangle Park. And, you know, it was the early days of that company before they went public. And, you know, they were still using reject doors from Home Depot as desktops for their desks. But it didn't work out because I was in love with a girl. And, you know, I tried to do the, you know, I was with her since I was 15 years old in high school. And I missed her so much when I went to North Carolina that I pretty much purposely sabotaged that job just to move back to Pennsylvania to be close to her again. And, you know, I was trying to do the right thing. We had a plan, you know, like, I'm going to go down here with this great job. She's going to go to school and we're, you know, when she gets done with school, we're going to be back together, live happily ever after. And, you know, I couldn't handle the job because I missed her so much and I left. And I went back to Pennsylvania and I went to work for the local internet provider. And, you know, that part was over. And I didn't know at that point if I would ever leave again. And I just wanted to be with her. So fast forward a few years and she's living, we're living in New Jersey together. She's working in New York City as a package design person for a design firm in New York City. And I'm working for some internet related company for more money than I ever thought I would ever make in my life. And I get an opportunity to move to California to move to the Silicon Valley. And at this point, my only experience with California was when I was a young kid and I had lived in San Diego with my father when I was young. And so I thought all of California was just beaches and palm trees. And went to the Bay Area and, you know, it was very different. Of course, Northern California is very different than Southern California. But I had no idea. This is how naive I was at the time. I was 23 years old when I got a job in the Silicon Valley working for a company called 24/7 Media, which I don't even know if they exist anymore. Probably not. And at this time, I was a very, very much a different person. I was completely sober by choice. I was what they referred to in the hardcore music scene as straight edge, and had never done drugs, never drank. And it was to the point where I was too critical. I couldn't go to any social gathering that involved alcohol on any level. and not a fear, it was an anger. It was an anger. And that anger came from being accused as a young kid of being on drugs or doing things that were considered bad, drinking. The odd thing is that I don't really even know what it was. I know my mother thought I was on drugs and I was accused of it often. And in my defiance, I made sure that I wasn't that person that she said that I was or that they thought that I was, that they just assumed I was. From what I can tell, because I was a cocky kid who thought that he always knew better for himself than his parents. And, I'll remember incidents where I would be out late, literally playing Nintendo video games at a friend's house. And I remember this particular instance. I was playing Excitebike, and you could make your own tracks on Excitebike, and you'd always choose that ramp that made your motorcycle go super high in the air. So I was playing around with that, and I was probably out till midnight, and I don't know, how old was I? Maybe like 13, 14, something like that. And coming home and being greeted at the door with my mother just punching me right in the face, like at the door, waiting for me, and her going completely insane and telling me that, she, just hysterical, asking me what she did wrong as a mother, and why can't I listen to her, and what am I doing, and you're on drugs, let me look at your eyes. I remember her saying that, let me look at your eyes. And it got to the point where she just couldn't handle it anymore. And her and my father, they were divorced when I was in the first grade. But her and my father got together, and I'll never forget it, because I was just so angry, because at this time I was into freestyle bikes and, I don't know, flatland freestyle. And if anybody remembers that kind of genre of bikes back in the 80s and early 90s of guys doing tricks on bikes. And there was a show the next day that I wanted to go to, I forget what they called it, like demos or something like that, but it was like traveling pro freestylers that would go and do a show. And my father came and picked me up and dragged me to his house in New Jersey without telling me what was going on. And I was flipping out because I wanted to go see this bike show. And I realized if I'm going to fucking New Jersey, I'm not going to see this bike show. And, still, I didn't know what was going on. And as it turned out, they had planned secretly to, my father picked me up, took me to his house in New Jersey. And then the next day, he took me to Philadelphia's Children's Hospital for their psychiatric ward and their ward for troubled kids. And I just could not believe that this was happening. I didn't know what I did to actually deserve getting institutionalized. I was not on drugs. Again, no one ever drug tested me. No one even asked to drug test me. If I would have, I didn't even understand, because I would have made the suggestion myself, but I just knew I wasn't doing drugs, and I didn't understand where they were getting this from. I've never been drug tested. And I had to go to this place and experience young children who were drug dealers, come from families that would rape them constantly, street thugs in the streets of Philadelphia, growing up in gangs or in families of gangs. Shit that I, coming from a small town, I didn't have one fucking clue about. I had no idea about this kind of life and these things that went on. And I had to see young kids acting out who couldn't even write their own name, who couldn't read, who came up in just the most disgusting part of society. And that really did something to me, that being exposed to that. And it's not the exposure to that situation, but it's this idea that I'm being lumped in with these other kids who are completely fucked up. I guess I'm fucked up too, just like these kids, just like these drug dealers or gang fucking kids off the street. Like this kid that tried to stab one of the staff with a fucking butter knife was full on like trying to kill this person in their mind, and having to watch kids get restrained on the floor and then being shot with something to calm them down. And this happening all the time in front of me, being forced to bunk I had to bunk with a kid who was diabetic, who tried to commit suicide by smuggling a bottle of Hershey's syrup into his room and then drinking the entire bottle to the point where he passed out on the floor in front of me, and I had to go get something. So I had to go get a staff person to save this kid's life because he was trying to kill himself by drinking this bottle of sugar, pretty much. And I remember things like finding pills hidden in the bedposts, and you know, it was like prison shit, you know. And you know, things happened to me in that place that I can never undo. And so this is my early childhood. I'm extremely bad with dates, and I think there's a psychological reason as to why I can't remember when anything happened. I remember very few things. I remember my first true love was at age 15 with Heather. I know that I was 23 when I came to California for the first time. I know I was 26 when I tried marijuana for the first time. I know when I was 30, on my 30th birthday, I did mushrooms and drove to Humboldt County and stood in the woods for an hour and then drove home. But that's about it. That's about the only dates that I can remember. So I try to use those as kind of markers as to when things happened in my life. So I was forced to go through this experience. I was in this institution for, I believe it was only like 3 months, which admittedly compared to some of the people that were in there, was a pretty short stay. But I don't think that really matters. And this wasn't the end of it. I think that first one was more my father's doing, my father trying to act like he's taking control of the situation. And then, you know, I came back and I don't know, it happened again. And I got sent to another place called UCCH, United Charities Children's Home in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And UCCH was nicknamed by the kids there, instead of United Children's Charities Home, they called it You Can't Come Home. And I watched a kid, I think he was 12 years old, a white kid, the story was is that he was repeatedly raped by his mother and father. He was completely captured by the system. His parents are in jail, and they're never going to see him again. And this kid is now cared for by the system. The first time I ever saw marijuana was in this home. And I was bullied by a kid to smoke it, and I refused to do it. He was smoking marijuana before he went to high school in Hazleton. We were forced to go to public school while we were staying in this home. And this kid that was being raped by his family and is now engulfed in the system and never to get out until he turns 18, took LSD, got completely naked, and then ran as hard as he could through a plate glass window. And, you know, he ran through a glass door. And the shards of glass were everywhere. And he was cut up. And lucky he didn't die, but, you know, just cut and fucked up. And you know, like, knowing what I know now, I almost feel as if him doing LSD was the excuse rather than the cause. People in that area will believe anything. The whole, like, oh, hey, he did LSD and jumped off the roof, and people buy that shit. And, you know, it was his way of doing this act and almost resolving himself of the responsibility of what he was doing. Oh, I did a tab of acid, so that's a 12-year-old kid. And I watched it happen. What did I do to deserve having to experience these things that I've seen in my life? What was I involved in that justified going to these places? And let me tell you, the second place, therapy, I was there, I think, 6 months at this second place. I saw a therapist maybe twice for 30 minutes. It's bullshit. It is bullshit. And this therapist is a county therapist who has to see 100 kids a day all over the place. And she's just asleep at the wheel. She's just trying to plow through her responsibilities and get home to her family and have a nice dinner. It was more of an opportunity for my mom to get away from me than it was an opportunity for me to be assisted with any issues or problems that I might have been having, or something terrible on the horizon that has yet to come up. And that I was always given that, you know, well, you know, we're trying to just make sure you don't end up in jail or dead, or and I don't get it. Really? Like staying out and playing video games and being a cocky asshole is you know, that's gonna end me up in jail or dead? Well, I don't know. I'll probably be trying to figure that out for the rest of my life, or I should try to figure out what I have to do to get over it. Because it still affects me to this day, and I'm 36 years old now and still fucked up by the things that happened to me when I was a young kid. And, you know, I talk to people, my friends, and people that I know that have been through terrible atrocities in their childhood. Things that, anything that I went through seemed pale in comparison, but I don't know. It depends on who you are. And, you know, it's not a contest to see who had the most fucked up thing happen to them. But these things shouldn't happen to anybody. And I always seem to fall for those that are slightly damaged in some way. Because maybe I'm trying to figure a way to seal to mend my own soul through someone else. Hey, this person had a fucked up life. If I can help them and if they'll love me for it, maybe I can love myself then. I don't know. So my first true love was a girl named Heather. And because I was institutionalized, I failed the 10th grade. And I ended up in one of her classes. And I remember Heather, she was always, in my mind, so beautiful and just so much more beautiful than everybody else around me. But she had a strange time in high school. Like, you know, she had her best friend that would always be there with her and be by her side. But even though she was one of those girls that I found very beautiful, she was kind of an outcast, you know, and kind of did her own thing. And I think that she spent a lot of time trying to find her own identity through being somewhat promiscuous with certain people. I don't know. She had that fucked up life between her crazy ass mother and her father, and her mother just doing disgusting things, having sex with young kids in particular, and really having that selfish attitude, not caring about her daughter, who in this small town, you can't do something like that and cover it up. Somebody's going to talk, and the kid's going to talk and tell his friends that he's banging this older woman that happened to be Heather's mother. And anyway, we were in class together, and I remember she would come into class and just go straight to sleep. Did not give a fuck about the class at all. And, you know, I found that funny and attractive. She put her head down, and it was her bleach blonde hair, just a puddle of bleach blonde hair on the surface of her desk. And I remember she came into class one day, and there was gum on her chair. I heard her bitching about this gum. And so I stood up and walked over to her and gave her a notebook I had that she could put on the chair so she wouldn't have to sit in the gum. And this is what I guess got us talking. And I remember, I will never forget her report card that year, because I had failed, and that's how I got into her class. And she was on her way to failing that year. Like, she had given up and didn't give a fuck anymore. She had too many F's to even try at that point to pass. So she had given up. and she had 32 Fs on her report card. And I think there was two grades on the whole report card for the year that weren't Fs, and they were like D minuses or something. Cracked me up. We were together for a long time. We were together for 8 years. And we went through a lot of stuff. I wasn't as messed up then as I am now. It's kind of odd because the things that drove her away from me really don't exist with me anymore. And my antisocial behavior, my inability to have fun, my hard stance on drugs and drinking that, you know, she couldn't even go to a work function that had champagne without me, like, having a mental breakdown. It just couldn't work anymore. Like, she had to leave. She didn't want that life. And, you know, this is so long ago, and I've had more than enough time to think about what happened there. And, you know, now she's married with, I'm sure, is a great guy. And I think she has two kids, or I don't know how many, but, you know, I've seen pictures here and there on Facebook of her with her kids, and she just looks happy as hell. And I'm really glad that she is. And that breakup was hard. It was very hard. And I went back to Pennsylvania after that, I remember. And being heartbroken and alone, and started to reach out to people from my past. And I always tend to do that. If something doesn't work out, then I have to go back to the last thing that worked, or the last thing that I was close to, or I always go backwards. And so I found Jill. Jill used to live up the street from me, and again, completely damaged, fucked up childhood. Father was a convict on the run. The story goes is that her father was once on America's Most Wanted, and Jill called America's Most Wanted and turned him in, and he hated her, or she thought that he hated her, or whatever it was. And I'll never forget Jill again. So beautiful. And she was the first woman that made me really appreciate a woman's body. Jill always had an amazing body. And she would climb in through my window and lay with me in bed. Or, you know, as a young kid. And she was almost the first girl I had sex with. And it's funny because I say almost because we were naked. And, you know, I put my dick down there, but just never put it in. I'm sure I was scared. And I was young. Since it was pre... Oh, and that's another date I remember. I remember losing my virginity at age 14. So if this was before I lost my virginity, I was probably like 13 or maybe early 14, somewhere in there. Which, wow, when I think about it now, that's just so young. And I never realized how young that was. And most people I hear tell me, you know, how old they were when they lost their virginity, and I'm like, fuck, am I messed up? I don't know if anybody's, you know, losing their virginity stories is is ever any good or exactly how they had pictured it would be. I lost my virginity to a girl who was, I don't know how else to say it, but she was just a mega slut. And she fucked a bunch of people, and these guys I knew, one guy was in the army, and he'd come up from the army and he'd pick her up and take her over to his grandmother's house, and he'd bring up a guy or two with him from the army, and they'd all take turns having sex with her in his grandmother's house. I remember being in a threesome situation. This guy was fucking her from behind, and she was giving me a blowjob. And anyway, that's the girl I lost my virginity to. And when I lost my virginity to her, of course, like many guys do, I fell in love with her and thought that I would save her, and she couldn't be saved. She would tell me, oh, I'm going to stop doing that. And then a week later, I'd catch her back at the house. They used to have this van that they called the fuck truck. And they'd drive her up and down the street. And in my shitty small town, one of the things to do is go cruising, which means drive up and down the fucking street back and forth and fucking wave to people that you see on the street that you know. And they would put her in the fuck truck and take turns having sex with her driving up and down the street. Anyway, Jill, I went back to Pennsylvania after my relationship fell apart with Heather and got a hold of Jill, and in no time, we meet a couple times, and now we're messing around, and she's got a boyfriend. Man, talking about this, it's just interesting to see the patterns emerge. She's got a boyfriend. Dude was much better looking than me, and probably cooler on every level, played in a band. I played in bands too, but that was long before this. Anyway, before you know it, we're moving to California together. And she ditched her boyfriend a week before we left, and we're in love. Here's the girl from my childhood, the girl who was crazy. I once watched a house that she set on fire burn to the ground. And I remember her telling me the truth many years later and how she felt so bad because it was her friend's house. She put her friend out of a home. And because of her manipulation and her power over this person, she also got this person to take full blame for it. And even though it was her fault, and she told me that they were smoking cigarettes and playing with matches or some shit, and this curtain had like that frizzy fur on it that, you know, women use as, what do you call that, a sash or I don't know, but you know what I mean. And she said this shit just went up like in a second, and there was nothing they could do. I remember riding down the street on my bike and watching that house burn. Jill, she did it. Too tall Ingersoll. That's what they called her in high school. And Jill has been through a lot of shit in her life. Molestation and all kinds of terrible, terrible things. And then Jill, like every other girl I've ever been with, not every girl, not every girl, but a lot of them, she started to fuck me over and got sick of my shit, and I don't know what it was, just wasn't what she wanted anymore, and she would cheat on me, and she started making porn on the side, and I was torn apart, and once again, brought another girl to California that completely ditched me and didn't give a fuck about me after a while. I don't know where Jill is right now. She's unavailable for the last month. The last I heard from her, she was going to India. But then she said she wasn't going to India, and now her phone doesn't work, and I didn't do anything to her. I don't think she has any reason to be upset with me, but who knows? Been going through a lot of shit these last few months, and maybe she just got sick and tired of me being down on life. And I understand that. Nobody wants to hear that shit all the time. But I don't know what to do, because I am down on life, and I can't really explain why I feel this way. When you look at my life on paper, it's amazing. I've had opportunities to travel and have money and nice things and the ability to explore. Not as much as I want to, but does anybody ever get to explore as much as they want to? You know, I don't know. But on paper, my life looks great. So why am I still fucked up? Why am I still unhappy? I'm trying to figure that out. I'm trying to unravel it. So I'm back and forth a few times between here and LA. Here being Silicon Valley and San Francisco. And there was a girl or two in there, short-lived. There was another Sonia. She was interesting. I remember her pressuring me into sex, which I didn't think would ever happen, but I remember her giving me the ultimatum. Either because believe it or not, like when I get into a serious relationship, I'm very slow to get into sex. I used to be anyway. And I would always be with someone for a period of time before just going full on into the sex thing. I gotta know them and understand them and have to be comfortable with them. But, you know, I finally ended up in L.A., and L.A. is where I wanted to be. It was my second time in L.A., and I had moved to San Francisco for a few years and had a good time in San Francisco because I had friends there, and you know, it was fun. But at the same time, it was a lonely city, and a city that's, in my opinion, not very accepting of people who don't have some kind of political agenda or point of view on gay rights or immigration, or, you know, and you need to have a stance on these things or you just don't belong in San Francisco. Yet it's such a hypocritical city with its history and its free love, and there ain't shit that's free in San Francisco. Let me tell you that. San Francisco is one of the most expensive places in the country to live. It is completely based off of capitalism. Don't buy into the hype of San Francisco. It's a beautiful city. And and it is a city that can grant you many interesting experiences for sure, but sometimes I feel like San Francisco tries to bullshit everybody else. I was there for 3 years, and other than kind of having fun, and Jill was living there and going on again and off again with her, and insane spirals of desperation. And I mean, there was this point in time where we had this little agreement that she was my sex slave, and I would let her live with me for free. But the deal was is that she had to fuck me or do whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. I mean, come on. Did I really think that was going to work? And then, you know, I found out deeper secrets. She's having unprotected sex as a prostitute. She's writing memoirs online about how she's waiting to get AIDS so she can die. And that was her form of suicide. And, you know, I went nuts. I have a huge fear of STDs, and until very recently took that very seriously, but some of my recent actions haven't been too fucking smart. So I'm back in LA, and I start going to this dive bar that I've seen on the movie Barfly, that happened to only be a block away from where I was living, in this place called Krabby Joe's. And I love this bar. It was a place where you could see pure insanity every day. And I met a girl named Cindy, who walked in the bar with two Australian guys and this other girl, a friend of hers, lifelong childhood friend. I was drunk, off my ass. Because the bartender, we became friends. We still hang out today. And just stopped charging me for drinks after a while. I pretty much went in there and just started drinking for free. And we'd take bong hits in the back room. And, you know, sometimes the door would get locked at 2 a.m. when everybody was gone. And they'd bust out the coke and start doing lines off the bar. And I never did that because I was too scared. But there was an excitement in the air, like we're on fucking Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles, and you know, we're blowing lines off the bar. And even though I didn't partake, I was in the air. It was in the air, you know. It was that excitement of just kind of rebel Los Angeles. And Cindy approached me. I think it was over Facebook or email or something. She told me she was interested in me. And I was honest with her in the beginning. I told her that I was interested in someone else at that time. And at that time, I liked this girl named Darlene. And we were hanging out a lot at that time. And you know, Darlene was another girl who I just found interesting, and she's funny, and I thought she was really attractive. And I told Cindy, I said, you know, I appreciate that, but there's this other girl that I'm kind of into right now, and it wouldn't be fair for me to lead you on. And then Darlene ends up hanging out with, I go to a concert with her, and she's a huge fan of John Frusciante from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and knows his whole story and his struggles with addiction, and she wanted to go to the show because bands were playing at this show. It was at the Knitting Factory that she knew he was friends with. And she just, as far as I knew, just had a suspicion that he might be there. And so I went with her, and I even bought the tickets, I think. And, I'm thinking like, oh, cool, she's going to maybe see John Frusciante and, you know, like you see a star in passing, you know, you see somebody you recognize from TV. It happens constantly here in Los Angeles, and anybody that lives here, it's just not a big deal anymore because this is where famous people live, so get used to it. Well, she ends up hooking up with John Frusciante, and, you know, what am I going to do? Fucking guitar player for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Well, I probably never had a chance to begin with, and I just really liked hanging out with her. She was fun, funny, you know, whatever. It was an infatuation. It wasn't head over heels, I must have you kind of thing. Well, she's with fucking John Frusciante, so scratch that off the list. I was also much more stable then. Maybe I would have took it harder if I was as fucked up then as I am now. But I didn't take it that hard. I mean, it's kind of cool, right? Like, she... Anyway, my mind has been blown by the fact that she even got to spend any time with this guy. So I actually really respect her for having that experience. But, so what I did was I contacted Cindy and I said, hey, let's go out sometime. Or I forget what I said, but she agreed and it turned into a 4-year relationship. And there was a lot of ups and downs, a lot of fighting. I lied in the beginning. Well, you know what? She likes to say that I lied, but I didn't lie. I made a mistake, and it was early in the relationship, and I went out and had a drink with a girl that I met on Craigslist. And I felt so fucking bad about it that as soon as I got back from this drink, I told her everything I did. Well, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have even told her. Maybe that was the right thing to do, is to just not tell her. Because from that point on, everything I said was a lie. Everything I did was a lie. She had anger in her that I've never seen before. And it peaked one day when I didn't want to show her text messages on my phone. And I would talk to people. I would talk to girls. And I talked, I think at this specific time, it was things that Jill was telling me. And I was telling Jill probably about, you know, problems I was having with Cindy. And people that are really close to me, like, I tell them everything. Everybody knows everything about me. And people that know me, there's no hidden secrets. And so we were arguing, and she took my phone, and I think she smashed my phone. And you know, there was a scuffle between us, and we've gotten physical before, but sometimes it would get pretty bad. And she turned around and threw shit in my face. Literally threw shit in my face. And she punched me and made the made my mouth bleed, and I just couldn't believe what was going on. Like, this is insanity. And I called the cops. And I never had this experience before, but apparently if you call the cops for a domestic dispute, it's no longer like, here, hey, why don't you stand over here and calm down a little bit, and then we'll take off as soon as you guys get your shit together. No, they dragged her ass off to jail. And had I known that was going to happen, I would have never have called the cops. I really did not think that that's what they do, but, you know, it was explained to me, like, if you call the cops for a domestic dispute, that's it. You're leaving. You're going. So she spent the next few days in jail, and I felt terrible and disgusting. I visited her in jail, and it was such a fucked up place to be, man. The attitude of those cops in there in the jail cell is just, you're even if you're a visitor, they just look at you like you're a scumbag and treat you like they have to treat people all day inside the jail. Anyway, Cindy never lied to me. Cindy never fucked me over. Cindy never tried to hide things from me. And I did to her what other women have done to me. And she doesn't deserve that. She never deserved that. Yeah, she's angry and she's crazy and she won't listen to you and she won't believe anything you say, and she constantly thinks the world is against her, and the last thing she wants is for people to treat her like she's insignificant. She has a violent temper, especially when it comes to making her wait. That's a pet peeve of hers that has resulted in just many, many arguments. And I just wish that maybe that she could have talked about things in a more constructive way. If she was able to express how she feels in a tone that is less hateful, maybe things would have worked out a little differently. But it was just from 0 to 100 in a second all the time. I don't know. I miss Cindy. I miss her a lot, because going through the shit that I've just went through, you realize a lot of different things. And maybe if I was there for Cindy in a different way, or if I was more understanding, or if I wouldn't have lied to her, or if I would have been upfront to her with her about things I was doing, or I swear I never cheated on her, though. Never cheated on her, never touched another woman. I mean, that doesn't justify the shit that I did, but she always liked to think, there's this idea that she had that I'm some player, and I never understood that, because I'm like the furthest thing from that.
now Cindy won't talk to me at all. I hang out with her brother, and he's always good to me. He's helped me quite a bit these last couple months when I've been going through one of the most difficult things in my life. I really appreciate him, because his advice actually has turned out to be true in a lot of cases. And I just wish Cindy would talk to me. I wish I could share things with her. I wish I could tell her these things that I'm speaking into this microphone and have her be understanding instead of angry and pissed off and just thinking about how she got fucked over. But I don't know. She thinks that I left her for Sonia. But I left because she wasn't going to let this thing happen. And it was going to be on her terms and her terms only. And anything else that I thought or, you know, assumed or wanted, it didn't matter. And then we get into Sonia. I met Sonia when her band came in as a guest on one of our radio shows. And I mean, she's beautiful. She is the most beautiful girl that I've ever seen. And, you know, like, initially, like, she's got a boyfriend, she's in this band, like, she's just a girl in L.A. that plays in a band, and there's plenty of them. And then she said that she went to school for sound, and I don't know exactly how it got put together, but the details aren't important. She started working at the studio. And she was good. She was really good. And she cared, man. That's the other thing. That's really what stands out about that time, and that I liked so much about her, is that she took this serious. She took what we were doing seriously. And she made it better. And she was there to cover things when I couldn't be because I had to go to work. And she put in a lot of hard work and was here for us, the studio. And she liked it, man. You know, we had so many cool people come through this place, and great musicians, you know, she's a musician, and she was having fun here. She once told me that she thought the studio saved her life, because she was at a point in her life where things weren't going so good, and she was doing a lot of drugs and having troubles throughout her life, and, you know, shit like that. Everybody has issues. But I didn't know the extent of those things at that time, and it wasn't really my business. And I tried to distance myself. I mean, you know, there were times where she looked so good that I had to, like, divert my eye. Like, could not look at her because I would lose my breath, and literally lose my breath, because she was so beautiful and just so desirable.
But I kept my distance, and I tried to be, you know, Mr. Employer, employee relationship, and you know, I didn't push things. She told her boyfriend a completely different story. He thinks that I had this all planned out from the beginning, my big plan. There's no fucking plan. Shit like this doesn't just get planned out. And I think, you know, the first sign was her telling me that she thought that I was attractive. And I was speechless. Like, this girl, I should have known, but how was I to know that this was all just a bunch of lines? And I couldn't believe it. I could not fucking believe that this girl found any interest in me whatsoever. And then I think I bought her a... She was trying to get a full-time job because we couldn't pay her shit. And she deserved it, man. She had these great jobs, and I don't know what happened, you know, why, but, you know, she tells me a story about how she was kind of set up to get fired and things like that, and she was on a long, dry spell of not having a full-time job, and she was trying to get a job, and I bought her a book on Amazon about how to write a resume and do job interviews or something. And I think I got her like a Klaus Nomi documentary just to be nice. And it went from there. And I remember before anything even happened, I made up this story that I told Jill. You know, I was talking to Jill about these things going on, and I made this story up about how I was helping Sonia on the console or something, and that she like turned and kissed me, and it blew my mind. It blew me away. And I made that up because I wanted to sound cool, and I wanted to not feel like such a piece of shit, I guess, that I guess the fantasy of a girl like her having an interest in me was just so compelling that I wanted to make up a story to just make it real in my mind. I wanted to make it real. We started going out and drinking. We were drinking a lot. I think Sonia likes to drink because that's her excuse. That's her way of dismissing responsibility for her actions. And so we would get drunk together, and she would get so drunk she couldn't even walk. And I remember the first time we got really, really drunk together and came back to the studio here, and she was rolling all over the place. And even at this time, I know I could have taken advantage of that situation, and I didn't. I had her lay on the couch here at the studio and try to sober up, and I just made sure that she didn't fall on her face and hurt herself. But I didn't touch her. I didn't make any advances toward her at all, because she's still with her boyfriend, and I actually did respect that. Contrary to the popular belief or the story she tries to tell people, that almost like takes her out of the picture, like she had no responsibility, like she was just in a trance or something, or unaware of what was going on. But that's not true at all. So I you know, kept my hands off of her. And then after a few times of her just staying at my place late or overnight, and I don't know what kind of boyfriend lets their girl stay out all night and doesn't ask any questions. I don't get that. I don't know. That seems pretty crazy to me. Especially with a girl like her. And then one night, she started talking about how horny she is, and she doesn't have sex. I don't know how a man could be around her and not. I mean, if you're the boyfriend of this girl and you don't want to have sex with her, I don't get it. But she started telling me all this stuff, and it was driving me crazy. It was. And at first, I just thought, like, whatever, you know, like, she's going to cheat on her boyfriend, and that's what she wants to do, and I'd be a fool to not take advantage of this situation and be with her. So we got real drunk at King Eddie's one night, and, you know, long story short, went back to my place and got it on. I was so nervous with her because I had never been with a girl like her. I had never been with a girl so dark yet so deep, so extremely beautiful yet so troubled, so intelligent yet so naive, so willing to go over the edge, not look back. And I just completely and totally fell for her. I bought into that whole fantasy. Full on. I wanted nothing more than to dedicate my life to this girl who is crazy. Completely fucking crazy. And I loved it. She is unlike anything that I have ever met in my life. And so after that night, it was just like all the time. And it was a few weeks of us just doing this thing we were doing. And I remember kissing her at the studio. There's like a blind corner where people in the talk room can't see you. And I would go to that little corner and she would come over and kiss me. And before I go to work, I would bring her breakfast sandwiches from LA Cafe just to make sure that she was eating well. And I didn't want her to think about anything. And, you know, she's so skinny that I just wanted her to be fucking, you know, fed. And one day before I went to work, we're here at the studio and I'm about to run off to work. She closes and locks the door and turns out the light and just starts giving me a blowjob right here on the studio couch. And I was in it. I was in ecstasy. I was
This is everything I ever wanted. Right here. This crazy girl. And so she told me it's always been her dream to go to New York City and make music. And she told me this. I swear to you that I didn't take one moment to even think about it. She said she wanted to go to New York. Then I'm going to New York and I'm going to make it happen. And it was that day that I was already looking for jobs in New York City to try to make this a smooth transition. And we made arrangements to have her cats shipped. I started booking the U-Haul. We moved the date up to make it go even faster. She went over to her house. And this was maybe a week before we were going to leave. She broke up with her boyfriend. And I remember her going there thinking that, like, somehow she thought that it was going to be okay or something, because I know that she had planned on staying there, like, right up until we left. But, you know, of course he freaked out, and that was it, and she was bringing all her stuff to my place. And I thought, well, okay, at least that's done. And I thought that I didn't think anything was wrong with how it was handled, I guess. If she wanted to be with me, which is what she told me she wanted, then, you know, of course she had to break up with her boyfriend. But, you know, then I started to notice the other kind of signs that this really wasn't what she wanted, and she wanted to keep things a secret from people, and she didn't want to tell anybody about us being together and stupid shit. Like, she didn't want to update her Facebook status, and she would tell everybody that, well, we're just going there to build a studio. You know, that's what we told everybody too. I told people that too. I would have rather have said the truth. I'm moving to New York City because Sony wants to go to New York City. And I want to make her happy, and that's why I'm doing this. No. Oh, we're going to build a studio in New York City. You know, I played that game even with myself. I tried to believe that. And it was total bullshit. I didn't give a fuck about building a studio in New York City. The money it would have taken to... We have a studio in L.A. that makes no money, so... I don't know. But I played along with it, and that was our excuse. So she wouldn't have to tell people that she is with me. And Vince told me once that when we were celebrating at King Eddie's or something, or, you know, we were all having a drink, it was right before we were leaving, and she muttered something about, you know, free trip to New York City, can't pass that up. I knew these things in the back of my mind. I knew that she didn't really love me, and that the things that she told me just were kind of half-truths, or maybe, you know, one day she did think she loved me, but, you know, some days she definitely didn't, that's for sure. And I just ignored it. I ignored it all. I completely ignored all the signs. I didn't want to see the truth, because I wanted this so badly that I thought just
plowing into it was the best way to do it. Plow right through this fucking wall and it'll all work itself out. What I wanted was true love. I wanted this girl to truly love me. But she didn't. I hope she loves her boyfriend. You know, she's back with him. There's still more to the story, obviously, but she's back with him, and I hope she does love him. I hope she does. My gut feeling is that she doesn't believe in love, that she doesn't know what love is, that she was taught at a very young age that love is something disgusting because of things that happened to her that make me sick to my fucking stomach when I think about it. She was taught at a very young age that love is bullshit because the people that love you are going to do really bad things to you at the same time. So anyway, you know, here we are. We're going to New York City and I'm ripping money out of my 401k plan like it's fucking growing on trees. I just don't care. Here's the money we need to move to New York City, live in fucking Manhattan, and have a great life. And I don't care. Everything came together. My job, I didn't have to look for a new job. My job said that I can work remotely. My amazing boss offered it to me, and I walked in there feeling like shit because I had just started this job. My boss had got me this job as a favor to get me into this position because, you know, I wanted to get out of my previous company so badly. And here I am walking in his office, you know, 6 weeks into the job and quitting already. And I had a few phone calls with companies in New York, but nothing that was solid. But I was fairly confident that I would have been able to get a job in New York City if I just gone there. But man, thank God that I didn't have to do that since all this shit fell apart and I had to come back to LA, or I wanted to come back to LA. I didn't have to worry about the job situation. I don't know how that happened, but, well, I do know, and it's thanks to my boss, but that was luck right there. We had the best time, in one of the best times in my life, going across country. We went wherever we wanted to go. We had no time limits. I was working from the road. I was working on the studio from the road. And we were just having a blast. And we were getting drunk in strange places. We went to Mount Rushmore. We went to Seattle. Had an amazing dinner in Seattle, thanks to my friends in Seattle who work at a restaurant. We went to Chicago. Stayed in the Drake Hotel in downtown Chicago. We had an amazing dinner in Chicago thanks to a friend of mine who's a head chef at a fancy restaurant in Chicago. And there was just, the road was beautiful. And we were fucking every night and getting drunk and just not caring about anything. Nobody was around. It was just us and the road and whoever we met along the way. And, you know, we went to some local bar in Minnesota, I think. Yeah, Minnesota. And met these great people. Gave them some marijuana from California that blew their minds. And, you know, it only took Sonya a few drinks to start talking to people. And we made good friends. And It was an experience of a lifetime. And at that moment in time, there was no one on this earth that I would have rather have been with on that trip. I loved her so much at this point. Everything I ever wanted in a girl. Fun. Just fun. And then we got to the East Coast. We had to stay with my mother in the town that I grew up in. And things started to get hard for me. I had bad memories of that town and being there and just being there, knowing that it's temporary, I feel trapped and there's nothing to do. And I don't know how not everyone in that town is a severe alcoholic, because what do you do? I guess, you know, you have families there, and that's what you do. You have kids, you have families, and you have your job, and that's it. Oh, man, we had such a good time. We got drunk together at this bar and then drove up into the country, and I took pictures of Sonia naked in a cornfield, and we had sex on the ground, and she was just beautiful and out of control and just everything that I loved. And we didn't have to care. And even being in that small town, I guess I felt a sense of entitlement because, I've seen the world now. Like, I'm so much better than all these people, and I'm here with this stunningly beautiful girl, and she's fucking cooler than anybody that ever was thought of in this town. And things were hard because I couldn't deal with, I freak out. I can't deal with sitting around. I can't deal with being in a place where there's nothing to do. I panic. I suffocate. I wanted out of there. It caused me a lot of stress just to be in that town. And I started just not being able to handle things too well. So finally, you know, a couple weeks at my mom's house, and it felt longer, but it probably was only a couple weeks. And we finally get into an apartment in the Lower East Side in Manhattan, 10 steps from Katz's Deli on Houston and Ludlow, 173 Ludlow 2D. And we were getting wasted every night. And the bars in New York City don't close till 4 a.m. And we're getting drunk, coming back, having crazy sex, doing it the next day, even though we would say to ourselves, hey, let's just not drink today. And we just go get wasted. And I got really insecure. In New York, I don't know why it's so different there, but it was obvious to me it was different. Maybe it was the neighborhood we were in retrospect. I don't know if that neighborhood was the right choice. I mean, for a lot of people, it was the greatest spot we could be in, but man, I could not walk down the street with Sonia without 50 guys trying to go up to her and talking to her. And she loved it. She liked it. She would give them her cards. She carried around these cards with like links to her music and stuff, and she loved that attention. And we were in the Bleecker Street bar one night, and I'm over on the other side of the bar just trying to get the bartender's attention to get some drinks. And I fucking turn around, and a guy is, like, hitting on her. And I saw that look in her face when she had to tell him in front of me that I was her boyfriend. And I saw that look on her face, and she didn't want to do it. She would have loved to have been there by herself and go home with some guy that would have gave her some excitement. And she told me this very recently, that she needs excitement in her life. This sexual deviance is part of that excitement. Well, things got dark. Things got bad. I could not function anymore. She would wake up one day, say she'd want to work things out and try again. She'd wake up the next day crying, saying that she wants to go home to LA. An hour after we signed the lease on our apartment, and I was so excited. I couldn't believe I have an apartment in New York City. An hour after that, she told me that she was not in love with me and not attracted to me. And I completely lost it. Consider what I'm telling you about her, and realize, like, what kind of devastation is that? I just blew all my money, and completely gave up my life in LA, which I liked. And I gave up everything, and I went with her to New York City and lost all my money. And I don't give a fuck about money. To me, the money is symbolic of my willingness to sacrifice everything. It has nothing to do with the money itself, but it is symbolic of my commitment to this girl that I thought was in love with me, because she told me she was in love with me. And she would tell me that she's going to prove it to me. Oh, I'm going to prove it to you. You'll see. And she looked me in the face and told me that she was not attracted to me and not in love with me. And then the next day, or in an hour from then she said she didn't mean what she said, and she was freaking out because of the apartment, and everything was kind of very real to her at that point. But we couldn't keep it going. Things would get insane, and I'd get crazy, and I would say things to her that I wouldn't say to my worst enemy, and I cursed her out and said vicious, disgusting things to her. And I turned into a monster. And, you know, monsters destroy things. And she destroyed things too. She was doing things behind my back and lying to everybody and never gave me that feeling like she really did love me, even though she would say it to my face. There was no actions. But things fell apart. Her parents sent her a plane ticket. She got on the plane and she was gone. Left all her stuff, left her cats,
That was it. She's gone. Then the next week or so for me was severe depression, not getting out of bed, staring at the wall, crying all day, not eating, not knowing what to do with myself, not working, just, I'm in hell. This is my hell now. My heaven has all of a sudden done a 180 and has completely turned into my hell. And I didn't know what to do. And I would try to get a hold of her, and I'd send her mom messages, and I send a nasty text to her mom, you know, telling her to fucking get that child molester out of the house and stop being such a loser, and you know, your daughter fucking smokes meth because of her fucking father. And then the next day I'd apologize. I didn't mean that. I was angry and upset. I always regret the things that I say. I use words to poke holes in people's souls. Well, I couldn't stay in New York. New York was completely ruined for me. I tried to go out a couple times. Not go out, but go outside. I didn't know anybody. I didn't want to know anybody. I didn't try. I just couldn't take it. So I hopped on a plane. And I said, hey, what do I got to do? The first thing I got to do is come back to L.A. and go work at the studio. I love the studio and I have fun there. I need to be around people I know, people that know me. And I came back here and I was hotel hopping for a good 2 weeks. And I was in her email, of course, because I'm the computer stalker guy. And I saw a text message she sent from a phone of herself to her email. And I just copied down the number because I had assumed it was her number, or I thought there was at least a chance. And when I got back to LA, I sent a message to that number, and much to her surprise, how did you get this number? I think I told her, oh, it doesn't matter. We met up. I had my mom ship a laptop that I had bought her out from my apartment so I could give it to her, and I gave her $2,000 when I met up with her. And we cried, or I cried, like I always do. And we were at Big Wang's across the street from the hotel I was staying in. And I've been trying to chase her down ever since. And she comes and meets with me, and we have a good time, and we drink together. I usually cry at some point trying to explain to her my undying love, and you know, I don't understand, and she'll tell me things like she cares about me and she does love me, but you know, I don't know. And then we fool around and then she leaves and then I'm a wreck, and I want her so badly, and I want her to be with me so badly, and I love her so much. A love that I've never experienced in my life. And it's probably not a healthy love, because she has fucked me over in every way you could possibly think of. And
I still would do anything for her. The only person that does that is a